This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Out here in California, it's being called the Godzilla El Niño. And after 4 years of drought, many Californians are pinning their hopes on a super strong El Niño to dump water, and lots of it, on the parched western U.S. Climatologists say warmer than unusual surface waters in the Pacific could mean more rainfall this winter, or not. Because there's another climate player in town, one that might put a kink in El Niño's plan. Enter the blob. KQED science and environment reporter Lauren Summer is here to explain Godzilla versus the blob, along with other selected short subjects in science. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi.
What is the blob?
Yeah, it's Godzilla versus the blob. That's what we're paying attention to here in California. Well, El Niño, you know, it is just ocean conditions, right? It's this warm water. It spreads along the equator, and sometimes it can send a lot of precipitation up here to California. That's big news for us. And so this week, what forecasters said was there's a greater than 90% chance that we will see a very strong El Niño this winter, right? Very exciting news. Here are the caveats, though. One, an El Niño doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get that rain here in California. If you look back, last seven El Niños back to 1950, actually three of them produced dry years. So that's one of the caveats. The other one is the blob. It's this blob of warm water that's sitting off the coast of California. And it's connected to the ridge of high pressure that we saw over the winter. It was dubbed the ridiculously resilient ridge. It was kind of like this linebacker sitting out there just blocking the storms that would normally feed us in the winter. And so scientists just aren't quite sure how the blob is going to interact with El Niño and whether that's just going to change the course of the precipitation this winter that we would really want to see.
So it's just a wait and see. Who wins?
Yeah, and
the blob.
And California state officials this week were trying to really temper expectations, right? Because we have some very strict conservation standards here in the state. I mean, there are water districts that have to cut up to 36% of their water use. And there's a lot of concern that if Californians are hearing, hey, we're going to get lots of rain this winter, but they're going to start slacking off on those long showers and watering their lawn. So there's some real concern that the hype is really going to hurt our conservation efforts.
This being California, it could be a new movie coming up soon. Next up, you've got something called yeast making opium. Well, that's something totally different.
It's a really interesting story. It's researchers at Stanford University, and they've taken yeast, which is, you know, baker's yeast, right? We use it to make beer and bread. They changed about 23 genes, and they actually made it imitate an opium poppy. And, you know, people know that a lot of painkillers that we use, codeine, you know, morphine, Vicodin, they come from opium poppies. And so what they did is they essentially made yeast into a little drug factory where it's kind of spitting out kind of these opiates that we use to make drugs. And the idea is, you know, down the line, eventually you just have a big vat of these yeast producing painkillers. You'd be skimming them off the top and you'd have a mini little drug factory right there.
Well, what's to prevent me from, let's say I'm a beer maker, I have yeast around all the time, from me getting some of this yeast and turning out my own opiates?
That's a big concern, right? This kind of home-brewed heroin concern. The researchers say that there's kind of two things right now that would prevent that. One, these are really finicky yeast, so they have to be grown in really special conditions, temperature controls. It's not something you could just toss in your garage and be producing drugs with. And the other thing is it's not very efficient yet. It would take thousands of gallons of these yeast to produce just one single dose right now. I mean, they're obviously hoping to improve the efficiency. Yeah. But, you know, this is synthetic biology. This field is growing by leaps and bounds. And it really points to the fact that we're all still having the discussions. What are the implications for this type of technology?
Yeah, very interesting. You've been following this next story for a few years now. Tell us about these elephant seal calls.
Yeah, this amazing thing happens in the winter here in California. Northern elephant seals arrive on the beaches, you know, in the hundreds. And if people haven't seen them, these are huge animals. The males are 4,000 pounds, 15 feet long. They have this big floppy proboscis nose kind of hanging off their front. And they're there to mate, of course. And the way that it works is there's these alpha males, and they have these harems of females that they control. And the beta males, right, they want to get in on the action. There's a lot of jostling for position, a lot of fighting. It's just these amazing fights where they're kind of rear up and they're lunging at each other. They get bloody. It's very risky. And so the researchers at UC Santa Cruz, University of California, Santa Cruz, have been recording the calls that these males make to try to figure out, you know, what are they saying to each other? And they found that they sound very different.
All right. We actually have a couple of clips. Let's listen to our first clip. Here's seal number one. It does. doesn't sound what you expect a seal to sound like, does it? Well, let's hear how that compares to seal number two. Oh, you can definitely hear a difference.
It's romantic, right?
Romantic.
Well, what they figured out is that these are individual calls. Each male has their own kind of signature call. And so what happens is that the males kind of arrive on the beaches, they start making these calls, and they all learn each other's calls. And the way they kind of figured this out is that the researchers were playing it back. And if the male heard a call from someone that was more dominant, they booked it out of there. If they heard a call from someone that was subordinate, they kind of aggressively responded. And so really, it saves energy for these elephant seals. They kind of learn each other's, you know, individual calls. They say, well, do I need to mess with that guy or not? And it kind of saves them energy from having to do so much fighting. So it's kind of like a bragging, jostling kind of male thing going on.
Mm-hmm. And you have a quirky story this week. Angelenos have been hearing a lot about shade balls. What's going on there?
Yeah, so essentially there's a reservoir in Los Angeles that's kind of been turned into one of those ball pits you might see kids playing in on a playground. They put 96 million black plastic balls onto the surface of this reservoir, and they just spread out like a giant blanket, and they're kind of floating there. It's there for two reasons. You know, one, it actually helps prevent evaporation. It's kind of covering it and preventing the UV light from getting in there, and they're saying that it could save, you know, hundreds of millions of gallons of water, which was obviously a big deal with a drought like the one that we're having. It also kind of blocks the light and prevents algae blooms, which is an issue for water quality. And the kind of footage of this is just incredible. It's like really mesmerizing for some reason just to watch these.
Yeah, I saw it on the news last night. The balls just rolled off a truck and they float. It's like they're sort of like about the size of what, a baseball, but they're all just black round plastic.
Yeah, just like sitting there floating. They say they're going to last for years. And, it, you know, they're 36 cents each. So the water district is saying, hey, we're actually saving money by doing this.
It's a lot cheaper than building a roof or some covering.
Exactly. That's what they're saying.
And the water.
And wow. The idea actually comes from, apparently they use these near runways of airports because it prevents birds from maybe landing in ponds, which would obviously be an issue for airplanes.
It's always good. People will come up with an answer when you have a problem. You know, just let people think about it. Lauren, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Lauren Sommer is KQED Science and Environment Reporter. Next up, it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And our story this week is a study that says butter might be bad for you. It raises your cholesterol compared to olive oil. But the strange thing about the study is that it was actually paid for by the Danish butter industry. Not who you'd expect to tell you, you know, something bad is happening or you should be watching your butter craving. Here to tell us the good and the bad is Roberto Ferdman. He is the writer of the Food Policy and Economics at Washington Post. Welcome to Science Friday, Roberto.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us the good thing here.
So this would be a trick question on a test if you were at school, because it's not very obvious. You kind of alluded to it. The fact that the Danish Dairy Research Foundation funded this study and it found that butter is not that great for you, or at least their downsides to eating butter, is actually the good thing. The reason it's the good thing is because it's very rare for an industry-sponsored study to find something that isn't favorable to the industry. And it presents a good opportunity to talk about how rare this is, which is what I did last week. Now, I've been chatting with Marion Nessel, who is at NYU, and she looks a lot at how the industry uses science to support you know, their mission and their business. And industry-sponsored studies, which she's looked at since March, she's found about 43. Of the 43, 42 of them have found something, you know, that is quite obviously favorable to the industry. So the good is that this is a rarity, and it allows us to point out how rare this is.
And the bad thing?
Now, the bad thing is the reaction, or at least the immediate reaction that I got from a lot of people to this piece. And it speaks to how used to studies and studies about foods we've become. Essentially, people are so jaded by being told that either butter is good for you or bad for you, that eggs are good for you or bad for you, that they assume that a piece that professes either is just going to be a you should eat more of this or you should eat less of this, or on Friday when, you know, you're at breakfast, it's okay to have some more bacon. People basically didn't understand the sarcasm in the headline, and we saw that in responses on Twitter when the Washington Post sent this out. We saw this on Facebook. I saw this in emails that were sent to me that were basically suggestive of the fact that people didn't actually read the piece. They just read the headline. They didn't understand that you know, there was sarcasm inherent in the fact that a study about butter funded by the butter industry found that butter is bad for you. So the bad is that there's a systemic problem with how we perceive studies.
Didn't the study, though, but in all fairness, didn't the study say that the butter actually raised your HDL level also?
It did.
Supposedly good cholesterol?
Moderately. You know, part of the purpose of the study was to look at how it compared to olive oil. So you're right. There are mixed results. You know, the conclusion wasn't that eating butter is terrible for you. That's definitely true.
Yeah. And of course, as you say, people are going to say, well, I'll just wait around till next week. There's going to be another study that tells me butter is, you know, is good for me somewhere along the line.
I hope
they get confused by all of this.
It makes for a better Friday. I'm pretty sure that people do actually turn this into, you know, actionable decisions where they're out at dinner and they decide, well, I'm going to have some butter on my bread tonight.
Yeah. Well, there was an interesting Coca-Cola story this week that's sort of like that.
Well, it's a little bit more of a scheme than that, but that's right. Coca-Cola has been funding a nonprofit which is basically giving a loudspeaker to research that suggests that exercise is more important in weight loss than diet. You know, what that means is that we don't need to drink less Coca-Cola. Yeah. We can just run it off.
Of course not. All right. Thank you. Thank you for explaining all that to us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. After the break, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk about how fires are reshaping the landscape in California and maybe keeping more water in the state, a surprising silver lining. So stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Firefighters in California are still patrolling the edges of the Rocky Fire up near Sonoma after it raged through nearly 70,000 acres. Today, the fire is still smoldering, but mostly contained. And contain is what we do, right? When fires start, we put them out as quickly as we can. It's a policy we've followed for about 100 years out west. And as a result, today's forests are so clogged with debris, kindling essentially, that fire can easily rip through tens of thousands of acres without running out of fuel, leaving what was once a forest looking like a charred moonscape. But there is one place where they don't try to put out natural fires. Maybe you've heard of it. Yosemite National Park. And it's become an interesting testbed for some of the changes that have happened to the plants, the soil, and the water after frequent, less severe fires take back the land. And the results are surprising, and that's what we're going to talk about, partly about the forest fires in Yosemite with my next guest, Scott Stevens, professor of fire science in the Department of Environment Science Policy and Management, UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Sally Thompson, professor of surface hydrology at UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Scott, how did we get into all these fires? Why are today's fires so catastrophic?
Well, I do think, like you just mentioned, that's legacy of really fire suppression for over 100 years now. Really, the early foresters looked at the land, thought it was actually understocked with trees, thought that they could actually do better to get more wood for America's people, and decided fire needed to come out. So you take a system and take fire out for so many years, a fundamental piece of that ecology, you're going to change it drastically. And that's what we've done in a lot of forests in California.
And so, Sally, tell us about what this unusual area of Yosemite is where fires have been allowed to burn. What's going on there?
Well, the area is called the Illilouette Creek Basin, and it's a wilderness area in Yosemite National Park. as part of treating it as a wilderness area in the 1970s, the park decided that we should stop interfering with the natural process of wildfires and instead allow those fires to burn. And that has allowed really the natural fire regime to be re-established. And Scott's work in that basin has demonstrated that we're now getting a fire there at any given point in the basin about once every 7 years. The reason we started finding this surprising is that the ecologists walking around were finding that areas that had been dry forests would burn, and that the plants that were coming up were now plants that we would normally see growing in wetlands. So we think something very interesting might be happening.
So the natural forest as it used to be was not returning?
It was not returning. And of course, this is early stage. It may yet turn into a forest again. But this initial process of succession was transforming the landscape into something quite different.
So you were getting a wetland there where you had a forest?
And we were talking about places that were lodgepole pine forests. This is normally a dry sort of place. You know, we go in and we measure water content in lodgepole pine forests today. And by the time we're at this point in the summer, there's no water left in the soil. But these burned areas, we go and measure the water content. There's a water table, maybe a couple of feet below the soil surface. And even at the surface of the soils are still wet.
How does the water get there? Where is it coming from? Do you know, Sally, where it's coming from? Or just rainwater accumulating?
Well, it's snow water, of course, when we're talking about Yosemite National Park. We don't have 100% of the answer to that story, but what we do know is that when we take a big, dense forest, it has a tremendous demand to use water to sustain its own processes of photosynthesis. Big forests also have deep root systems, so they can get at that water from a very large area in the subsurface. If we take that out, we've taken out a lot of the demand for that water in the short term. So we think there's just extra water in the landscape in the Illilouette Creek Basin. And some of that is probably becoming concentrated by topography and by geology into these new wetlands.
Wow. As Scott and fires are pressing reset on the type of plants that recolonize the landscape in other places too, right?
They sure are. You know, we're seeing areas that, you know, patches. It's one thing about Illilouette's just fascinating. You can go there. You can just walk there out of Yosemite Valley for maybe about a three-hour hike. You can see all these patches of forest. Once it was continuous, we've got a set of air photos, 1969-70, where we see really a canopy of trees for everywhere. And Illilouette actually had 100 years of suppression, just like the Forest Service. Their fires were out of there until 1974. The last fire was 1875. We got a record of it. So you go in there today, 3 acres, 2 acres, patches, openings, other areas, dense forests. The mosaic of vegetation there is phenomenal. And I think that's part of the dynamics is why we're seeing maybe changes in hydrology and also increases in forest resiliency. The forest is very resilient today to fire and climate change.
So what happens? Why does not another fire come in and burn through these areas?
Well, they still do today. You know, lightning fires are actually occurring there. The park, with its management, tries to allow all the fires to actually occur. They do smoke out the Yosemite Valley sometimes, maybe a little bit of suppression. But since the continuity is so low, when the fire moves, it doesn't have the chance to really increase its severity, increase its flame lengths. It hits a discontinuity, goes to the ground, goes over here and goes out. We even did one study that if an area had burned 9 years previously, so the interval between fires was 9 years or less, and 95% of the time, the fire went out at the boundary with no human action.
Now, can you apply this knowledge to these large fires or the areas where these large fires are occurring?
I think you could, because if you look today, you know, we know we have problems with forest restoration. We know we have problems with climate change. So today, I think it's an exciting opportunity maybe to think of Illilouette, as Sally's described, and actually think, how can you move that maybe to different parts of the states, both to increase resiliency of forest to fire and climate change, and also potentially to change hydrology, things like aquatic ecosystems and downstream users. So the Forest Service is out now doing its plan revision throughout the state of all national forests. The last plans were revised in 1980. So this is an opportunity really of a generation.
Can you learn anything about how global warming is reshaping the kinds of vegetation that's growing?
You can too, because we're seeing, as you know, snow is melting earlier. It's a drier environment. And we do have a Kate Wilkin, one of my PhD students at Berkeley, is actually looking at this very question, looking at really what's happening in the understory and the diversity of the understory. And the diversity of the understory is incredibly diverse in the Illilouette Creek. Even the pollinators, another student looking at pollinators finds that the pollinators are diverse. So ecosystem seems to be much more in tune with the diversity and also the dynamics of that ecology.
Sally, are there other places where you've been able to observe the same kind of phenomena?
So in California, in the Sierra Nevada, there's only one other basin that has been allowed to develop this natural fire regime, and that's also in a national park, in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. Again, it's a wilderness area, and it's called Sugarloaf Creek Basin. Our difficulty with Sugarloaf Creek Basin is that by comparison to Yosemite, it hasn't had the same level of observations and management applied. So while we can, for instance, measure the stream flow downstream of the Illilouette Creek Basin in Yosemite National Park, we don't have any equivalent measurements of hydrology and even of the weather in Sugarloaf Creek. So we're very suspicious that very similar things might be going on, but at this point we just don't have the data available to be able to say exactly what's happening there.
Mm-hmm. Now that you've learned all this interesting stuff about how to prevent forest fires by allowing natural processes to happen, can you convince politicians? I mean, this has got to be, no pun intended, a politically hot topic, right? Letting forest fires burn? Yeah.
And there would be some places where that would not be a good policy response, right? So we shouldn't be doing that on the outskirts of Los Angeles. What we are going to be advocating when we start putting these results before policymakers is to be thinking very strategically about the regions where this is likely to be useful and feasible. And so some of the constraints that really come into play are, of course, how isolated an area is, its proximity to some sensitive set of users who you just don't want to be exposing to a fire risk, but also issues around air quality, as Scott's already mentioned. And finally, we need to think carefully if water is going to be part of our rationale for thinking about fire management, we need to think strategically about where this is going to have the greatest value. And that's likely to be in places where right now forests are chewing up mm-hmm. the largest part of the water balance.
Is there any pushback from environmentalists?
Well, this is an interesting question. You know, I think in some ways, most environmentalists in the state really like to see fire begin to work land more. The challenge is we're seeing some fires work land, like the Rim Fire, the King Fire. These are fires in the Yosemite area that actually have burned in the last few years where 250,000 acre fire, but patches of mortality in excess of 10,000 acres. So those types of fires are outside this desired range of variation. We're not getting forest back. We're basically going to have climate change impacts. So I think it is possible that you could actually get more people interested in this. And right now with the plans going forward in California, the three national forests that are ahead of this are the Sequoia, Sierra, and the Inyo. And I think they've actually designated over 50% of their land base potentially for fire use in managed wildfire.
But what about environmentalists who may say, you know, if you put out these fires, or if you don't put out the fires, isn't there wildlife, owls, whatever, that you're not going to be saving?
That's a great point. You know, you look at the California spotted owl now, and this is actually something that's being discussed in the state right now, is can you actually have resilient forests with the conservation of the owl? I think the past practices have been trying to maintain the owl's habitat everywhere it exists today, almost like putting artificial boxes around it. Artificial boxes around forest landscapes not going to work. So mm-hmm. the idea then is, can you actually think about maybe a conservation strategy that allows the owl to prosper, maybe in a more limited range, but also allow the forest itself to basically evolve and be resilient? So, yes, there are real questions about wildlife, probably the biggest issue.
Can this be applied to other parts of the country, this kind of idea?
I think it absolutely can. This policy of fire suppression is not unique to the Western United States. And in fact, the southeast of the country is well known as an area where fire has shaped ecosystems, and the longleaf pine ecosystems down on the Georgia, South Carolina coast are perhaps the prototypical example of that, where those mm-hmm. those savannas just aren't persistent in the absence of fire. I don't think we know very much at all about the effects of fire regime on water in general. So whether this is going to be universally the right solution for thinking about better water management in our forests is likely to be much more site specific. It's an open question in my mind.
But are people now considering what other alternatives you don't or do have? Are they more open to listening to these sorts of things?
I think they are, because if you look, just like you say, you know, what's going on today, continued fire suppression costing us $1.5 billion per annum now, more and more areas being lost, structures lost. So the equivalent is continue to do this forever or look for a different means, a different trajectory. I think the trajectory we're talking about makes a lot of sense.
So where do you go from here? What kind of other research would you like to? What else do you need to know?
Well, we actually need to know an awful lot more than
Tell
we currently
that. Tell
do.
Us about that.
So right now, I guess the fundamental issue that we're confronted with in trying to make sense of what we see up in Illilouette Creek is that when folks changed the fire management, they weren't thinking about water and they weren't thinking about biodiversity and they weren't thinking about any of these other issues. So we don't have very good baseline data. So right now we are in a process of really trying to quantify what's happened, trying to characterise the kinds of changes in vegetation that have actually happened through really historical detective work, and trying to pin down the mechanisms that are relevant. If we can pin down mechanisms, we're in a much better position to make predictions in
what
other
kind
places.
Of, yeah, what kind of mechanisms are you talking
about?
Well,
this is a snow-dominated landscape, yeah. And it turns out we know very little about the interaction of snow and fire,
is
which
right?
is surprising, right?
Yeah.
Because we have so much fire in our mountain catchments. So the sorts of things that we're really interested in is how important, for example, is the role of changing the forest structure for how the snowpack behaves versus that problem I already mentioned of how much water the trees want to use. And those are two things that happen at very different times of the year. Black stumps get a heck of a lot hotter than trees that are covered in snow. So the melt dynamics of the snowpack in spring are likely to be very different in these burned landscapes. That might be a really good thing. That might get that water into the soil, into the rivers much earlier than it otherwise would be, rather than sitting there as snow that can sublimate back to the atmosphere. But we don't really know which of these is the dominant mechanism.
And you're going to have a lot, you have a lot less snow in the snowpack now also, right?
In some places, yes.
So you have to figure that in?
Well, we're really hoping for that El Nino this year so that we can actually have some yeah. snow to measure. That has been a challenge. We've been looking at this in the context of drought.
Yeah, we talked about the El Nino versus the blob.
Yeah, we're gunning for the El Nino at this end of the table.
How much research is there really into forest science, about what goes on in forest science? Is a lot of money poured into it? Scott, I'll ask you both, Sally, the blank check question I give my guests sometimes, which is if you had an unlimited blank check amount of money, where would you put that money? What do you need to know? Where would you like to invest that money? Sally, you can go first, Scott. Scott.
I think one thing, I like the idea of this interdisciplinary work. You know, I've been working in Illilouette now for about 10 years, and having Sally in here, you know, looking at the hydrology piece, we're also looking at carbon sequestration and carbon kind of how much force can the carbon get into that forest. So the idea of interdisciplinary work, right. working together is cool. And that forest research is being funded moderately. It's a lot better than it was 20 years ago. There's a joint fire sciences program that actually funds research on a call every year. So money is out there that actually to do some of this work.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, coming to you from San Francisco and talking about what everybody's talking about here. If it's either the lack of water, it's the big forest fires. Talking with Sally Thompson, Scott Stevens. Sally, do you have a blank check that you could use someplace?
Well, of course.
Never got a no on this question,
I'm sure
ever.
No, you haven't. I think for the sake of this particular problem, we could really use a lot more test cases to explore. I mean, the fundamental limitation of everything that I've told you today about the Illilouette Creek Basin is I'm talking about one site, and it has a unique geology, it has a unique history. It would be fantastic for the sake of understanding this problem to be replicating the experiment of the Illilouette Creek Basin in 10 or 15 other locations that spanned things like the rainfall snow gradient in the Sierras, that also picked up different vegetation types and different geologies, and really, as we've already alluded to, went right across the country.
Yeah, so you're looking for partners to do this in other places. Would you be helping them or guiding them, or what other places, for example?
Well, to start with, what we'd really like to be able to do is to use what we've learned as motivation to try doing this in other places. And this is where really working collaboratively, as Scott's saying, across disciplines is very helpful, because Scott heads up, at least in California, a coalition of fire science researchers. So we have potentially lots of partners right up and down the state to work with. Mm-hmm. The challenges are really, as you've already alluded to, in convincing people that this is a safe and reasonable thing to do. And so we're sort of at the beginning of that process.
And there's one other place where the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico is another very large area that's had managed wildfire for 30, 40 years, and also the Bob Marshall and also in Montana, Idaho. So there are a couple other places one could actually work and actually look at some of these issues today.
But you've got to be able to bring people in and show them this and say, look, your eyes aren't lying to you. This is what happens when we... Right? They bring people in and say,
right.
take
so
a look at this.
I think right now we can show people their eyes and show these sort of transformations. What I'm not yet feeling like I have the perfect numbers for is, you know, this is what it means at the large landscape scale. So really, we have to talk about this as being a work in progress in that sense.
Yeah, because the Forest Service has been allowing these fires, putting out the fires for 100 years, right?
They have.
When did that start as a practice? Well, I guess you can't look at a fire and not say, we have to put it out.
I think that started right around 1905. Forest Service was created in 1905 by legislation from Congress. And one of its first two missions was actually, after a short deliberation, is to put out fires really for timber production. The idea was, you know, you got 40 trees per acre in the Sierra Nevada. Looking at all that open ground, they said, well, we can get 200 or 300 trees if we get the fire out. So they did it in good reason. You know, if I put myself back in 1905, I might have made the same choice. But today, with 100 years of experience, we now know that forests are in such more vulnerable conditions that early idea of trying to get more timber for the U.S. population was a good idea, but it went sour.
So you're hopeful this will work out?
Actually, yeah.
You're optimistic.
Yeah, even if we look back into the late 1990s, the Forest Service has been very self-reflective and self-critical of the consequences of fire suppression. And I think there's a lot of scientific will behind changing that.
Well, thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Scott Stevens, Professor of Fire Science at the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management, UC Berkeley, also Berkeley. Sally Thompson, Professor of Surface Hydrology there. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and after the break, if you're an octopus person or a panda person, we have some animal facts in store for you, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, it's Science Friday here. We love the octopus. Whether it's octopus camouflage or weird walking behavior, we are fans of those eight-limbed sea creatures. So when this week we got word of one species of octopus, the larger Pacific striped octopus, that breaks a lot of the standard octopus rules, we needed to talk about it. And we brought in an expert, Richard Ross, whose discovery of the unique octopus behavior is published in the journal PLOS One. He's a senior biologist at the Steinhardt Aquarium in California Academy of Sciences, and he's with me here at KQED Studios in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us about this weird behavior.
Well, there's a bunch of the weird behaviors. So the two biggest weirdest behaviors would be the way this octopus mates and the way it hunts food. So the hunting of food is pretty spectacular. You know when you're sitting with somebody and you reach behind them and touch them on the shoulder and they don't know your arm is behind them?
It's like a little trick you're playing.
Yeah. That's what these guys do. So they stalk their prey as well. Most other octopuses just pounce. So these guys stalk up and then they slowly reach an arm up and over the shrimp and tap it behind it and make it run towards the octopus.
Oh, it thinks it's on the other side and runs right in the wrong direction.
Exactly. I think we need to come up with a phrase for what that tapping your friend on the shoulder is and call it that. And then it runs right into the octopus and they catch it that way. Yeah. So that's pretty spectacular. And
you did an octopus on somebody. We'll come up
you
with
get
a
an octopus
phrase.
On somebody. I like it. I like it.
I tell you, and it works every time.
It doesn't work every time. No. Eating capture behavior works every time, but it works a lot
because they're smart. Those octopuses.
They. I like to say they appear smart because it's so hard to, you know, parse out what smart is. But they absolutely do things that appear smart.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the mating weird behavior.
The mating is the weirdest behavior because, in general, octopuses want to get away from each other because they tend to eat each other, or at least that's the prevailing wisdom. Perhaps this research will show that more don't do that, but it looks like only this one does this. So, normal octopuses will mate either from far away from each other with the male's specialized sperm matrefor-depositing arm reaching out across, or the male will mount the female up on the mantle back behind the octopus away from the female's arms and mouth. These guys mate beak to beak or sucker to sucker. So underneath the octopus where the arms all go together and the suckers kind of come to a point, that's where their mouths are. And these guys mate beak to beak with their faces pressed together and their arms touching and their suckers all lined up.
Unusual among octopuses.
Incredibly unusual. Very strange.
Are octopuses normally loners or do they live with packs or together? Or?
Yeah, normally they're loners or normally we think they're loners. And we, of course, need to do more research out in the field and see what they're doing in the wild. But they're mostly loners. When you keep them in aquaria, you always keep them alone because you want to continue to have octopuses and not have them eat each other.
The strange case of tapping the shrimp, is that something that they learn on their own, or is it passed down? Is it hardwired in their genes or something?
No idea. That we'd love to know that answer.
Now, I know that you, because we've talked about this before, about what is the correct plural for octopus. People always say octopuses like you do, or octopi. But I understand you have a whole new word I've never heard of.
Yeah, there's it comes from Greek. So the right way to do the plural of octopuses would be octopodes.
Octopodes.
Octopodes. But people will hit you if you say that. So I don't recommend you say that. But octopuses is more correct. Octopi is also acceptable because when you bring words in from other languages to English, you can Latinize them. Mm-hmm. But we all use octopuses.
What is there about octopuses that you would like to learn that you haven't learned? There's just a lot of stuff that they do.
Yeah. I would like to be able to know how intelligent they are and how we could quantify that. And with the larger Pacific striped octopus, we absolutely would want to know why they're mating beak to beak. What is that?
Do you have any thoughts about what it might be?
Well, another interesting thing they do, which is different from almost every other octopus except their cousin, is they lay multiple clutches of eggs. You know, around Mother's Day, we get that story about the octopuses that give all, the mother gives all, and she tends her eggs, and then she dies. And these guys, not so much.
No.
These guys, we had one for 8 months that was continually laying eggs. And so we're having eggs hatching the whole time. So concurrently, we had all different developmental stages of eggs going on. And when the female is brooding, she is sitting at her den with her mouth parts and her suckers exposed at the entrance, presumably to protect it. So perhaps that mating came across because when a male comes up, that's the position they're in, and it's actually safer to negotiate front to front than it would be to try to find a different way to mate.
Looks like you just love to talk about octopuses.
I love octopuses. They're the coolest animals on the planet.
Why? What got you interested in versus other marine?
Well, I like other marine things too, but octopuses are aliens on our planet. I mean, they're the closest thing we're going to get to that. They have eight arms. They have suckers all over the place. They have great eyesight. They can make ink. They can swim. They have jet propulsion.
We have a video. We saw them running also.
I
never thought they
can walk bipedally. The more we learn, the more interesting they become to me.
So if you went to another planet and you saw these things, you'd say, wow, what a weird life form they have here, but we actually have them on our own planet.
Yeah, so what else do you have?
Is there a lot of research that goes on in studying?
I don't know if there's a lot because there could always be more. So there is a lot.
Is there an experiment you would like to do that you can't do yet?
I would like to get into the field and get really good observations of what these octopus are doing in the wild. So we would know how often are they mating with each other. Do they pair bond? Because sometimes these guys stay in the same den, the male and female. They also seem to occur in groups. So there could be 40 of them in the same area. And what are they doing all day? How are they interacting? We don't know that.
The fact that they're called the Pacific striped octopus, are they just out here? In the Pacific?
They're in the Pacific, off the coast of Central America. There's also a lesser Pacific striped octopus, which we should really call the smaller Pacific striped octopus, so at least the first letter of the initialism is different.
Not a lesser versus larger.
Yeah.
Does it have the same behavior? Or different?
It's got different mating behavior, more standard mating behavior, but it also does lay multiple clutches of eggs, so it does that, which is very bizarre.
I see you hate your job.
I absolutely hate my job. Not at all. I think I've got the best job in the world.
Richard Ross is a senior biologist at Steinhardt Aquarium at the California Academy of Sciences. Can you see the octopi? Octopodes? Octopodes. Are they exhibit out there?
Not yet. We're hoping to get down to the Central America and get some more and put them on display again.
Okay, the octopodes. Octopodes. I'll get it right. The octopodes. Senior biologist, Steinhardt Aquarium and California Academy of Sciences. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. And you can see a video of the hunting behavior on our website at sciencefriday.com/shrimp snack.
Nice. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Is Mai Zhang with Cub? The National Zoo's female giant panda has scientists and the world wondering whether or not she's pregnant. Mai has previously given birth to four cubs at the zoo, two of whom have survived. She was artificially inseminated again in April of this year. But when it comes to figuring out whether or not a panda is actually pregnant, really, there's no easy way to do it. There are no easy clues. Even an ultrasound can't do the trick. And here to explain why panda pregnancy is just so darn mysterious is Pierre Comizzoli. He's a professor biologist at the National Zoo who works with the pandas and assists with her artificial insemination. Welcome to the program, Pierre.
Good afternoon.
Tell us why it's so difficult to know. Why can't you ultrasound a panda, for example, to tell if it's pregnant, like we do to people?
Well, because the big difference that we have with the giant panda is that the fetal development is really, really limited. Can you imagine? The female is about 100 kilograms, and she's going to give birth to a baby that's only 100 grams. So there is a huge difference between the size of the mother, the size of the abdomen of the mother, and really the fetal development. So in terms of ultrasound and imaging, it's really, really difficult to see something.
How do you know then whether the panda is pregnant? You just wait?
Yes, we have to wait until this period of time where the progesterone levels are decreasing, and when we are back to a level near to zero for the progesterone, we know that we are at the end either of a pregnancy or a pseudo-pregnancy. And if we don't see a baby panda, that means that, unfortunately, the female was not pregnant.
Well, how long do you wait? What is the term of a panda pregnancy?
Well, that's also an interesting question, because pandas have a delayed implantation. That means that the length of the gestation is variable. It can be a little bit less than 3 months, but it can be also up to 5 months and a half. And this is due to the fact that at the beginning of the pregnancy, the embryo is going to stop before the implantation. And this period of time where the embryo is going to stop is really variable from one pregnancy to the other. And then after that, the embryo is resuming the fetal development, and then there is the birth. So the problem we have is that it's really difficult to know exactly what's the length of this pregnancy. But we measure at least the progesterone that's always giving us a pattern that's the same between a pseudo-pregnancy and a pregnancy.
Were you involved in the artificial insemination in April this year?
Yes, of course. I've been involved with the artificial insemination of Meisheng since 2004.
Is it hard to impregnate a panda?
Well, that's also a lot. That requires a lot of people and a lot of observations and monitoring on the female, because the breeding season only happens once a year, and the female is able to conceive only between 24 to 36 hours. So we don't want to miss the window of opportunity, but we have several ways to monitor that pretty well and to do the artificial insemination at the right time.
It's also interesting to note that she's had pseudo-pregnancies.
Yes, that's that's really interesting. And this is not unique to the giant panda, by the way. Even what I was talking about before, the delayed implantation, that's seen also in hundreds of species. But what's really interesting is that no matter what, pregnancy or no pregnancy, she will always have the same level of progesterone. So this is really intriguing, because, again, there is no way to make a difference between a real pregnancy and a pseudo-pregnancy.
So it must be really disappointing when you find out you thought she was pregnant and she's not pregnant.
Of course. And it's extremely, yes, really disappointing. But let's go back just for a second to the ultrasound, because there is a possibility toward the end of the pregnancy, maybe the last 10 days, if there is a pregnancy, sometimes, if you're lucky enough, you can see something. So that's what we are trying to do. And we are hoping that we are going to be able to see something. But again, even if we don't see anything, that doesn't mean that she's not pregnant. So everything is complicated with giant pandas.
Sure sounds that way. Talking with Pierre Comizzoli, a research biologist at the National Zoo, on Science Friday from PRI. Public Radio International. Are any other? Why are pandas so difficult this way?
Well, this is really an interesting species because it's a bear species that has evolved completely by itself in the bear family. And they live in a really specialized area, you know, in the central China, in the bamboo forest. They are carnivores, but they adapted, you know, their diet to eat, you know, mostly bamboo, so it's really special for them, and it's kind of unique to have a carnivore, you know, that feeds only with basically fibers, and the breeding season again is only once a year, and the female can be impregnated only you know for a short period of time, and then after that there is this really variable gestation period that's an adaptation also for the mother to make sure that she's going to give birth at the baby at the optimal time during the year when there will be plenty of resources for the mother to eat and to produce milk to nurse the baby.
Wow. Very complicated. Pierre, good luck to you and the pandas.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Pierre Camazzoli is a research biologist with the National Zoo. Oh, one last thing. Today is the 70th anniversary of VJ Day, you know, the end of World War II. And a famous photo taken in Times Square celebration showing a sailor kissing a nurse, bending her backwards. Remember that one? What time of day those lips met has never been determined. Until now, astronomers at Sky and Telescope traced the sun's shadows on the buildings, and they have pegged that time to 5:51 p.m. And in case you missed it the first time, you can head over to Times Square today, where they're going to be doing it again at 5:51 today. Oh, and have you joined Sci-Fi Book Club yet? Yeah, we're reading Tracy Kidder's love letter to computer engineers, The Soul of a New Machine. And if you want to get in on the fun, you can not only join the book club, you can join us August 24th at Google headquarters in Manhattan. Tracy Kidder will be joining us in person to talk about the book. New Yorkers, don't wait. Get in on this before space runs out. Go to sciencefriday.com/meetup to reserve your spot. And over in Lake Erie, they're witnessing one of the world's worst blue-green algae bloom in a decade. It's our picture of the week. Check out our bloom from the vantage point of a drone at sciencefriday.com/algae. Before we go, I'd like to thank Jim Bennett, who's spinning the dials here at KQED, and give a shout-out to Monte Carlos and all the fine folks at KQED in San Francisco for the hospitality. Charles Berkowitz is our director back in New York, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer, our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer back in New York. Of our production, there with our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. As I say, I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.